Have you ever asked yourself what salt portrays symbolically in the Bible? When it says that, you know, we're the salt of the earth, that represents something. And it represents something in the course of it being laid out in various scriptures. And I want to share that. I want to walk through part of that with you today. I have to start in a passage that's very familiar to us on counting the cost. That's a memory scripture. Most of us could say Luke 14 is the passage on counting the cost. Because salt is tied into that in a way that in reading the New King James, you might consider it as a separate subject. But it's actually part of the actual story flow. In Luke 14 and verse 25, the passage starts. Actually, 26 is where Christ begins to speak. He says, if anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his father, mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters, the point is, if there is anything in this life that you love more than me, if there's anything in this life that comes before me, you cannot be my disciple. Whoever doesn't bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And here's verse 28, where we've taken the title of what we call it, counting the cost. Which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether you have enough to finish it? Lest, after he's laid the foundation, is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him and say, this man began to build and was not able to finish. So if you go through and you walk your way through, as we do in baptismal counseling, this passage, there's two main points that are brought out, at least two. We have to be willing to forsake everything that we have. It doesn't say we have to forsake it. We have to be willing to forsake it. We have to be willing to put God first. And we have to be willing and committed to finish what we have begun. All of us know people who believed the same things that we believe that have then since turned aside and gone their way. God knows what the finish of that will be. Hopefully, indeed, some of those people can be brought back to repentance. But we have to be able to finish what we have begun. We have to endure to the end. Now, that's where the passage for us stops. We read down verse 33. It says, so likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. And then the passage is over. The counseling stops. But verse 34 actually continues in the passage. It's not a totally new subject. It's not a different subject. It's just a continuation of the passage that is here. It goes on and says, salt is good. But if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill. But men throw it out. He who has an ear, let him hear. When you see the statement, he who has an ear, let him hear, doesn't that kind of ring a bell? Revelation 2, Revelation 3, the messages to the church. This is a message to the church, and it's in that kind of a context. A number of Bibles translate the passage here in verse 35 a little differently. Many of the commentaries will say, well, this is difficult in terms of the technical translation. But let me at least read you a couple of things that make it at least would seemly be simple. The Living Bible, in this case, says, flavorless salt is fit for nothing, not even fertilizer. It's worthless and it must be thrown out. When it says it's not fit for the land needs a percentage of salt. When you have cattle out on the range and you need to add to their nutrients, you put out a salt block so that they have the nutrition that is necessary. Wild animals will find soils that have the salts in the soils and actually will lick out of those soils the nutrition they need, the nutrients they need for their health. When it talks about the dunghill is animal waste. Animal waste like you would have at even a feedlot or by side of a barn where you pile it up into a big pile. Animal waste actually had a purpose as well. It had a purpose in terms of the fertilizing benefit of it, and it also was used to be burned. If you've never burned cow chips, you just haven't lived. As the wagon trains came across the prairies and they lived off of the fuel that they could use from the buffalo chips that were out amongst the grass. And so the dung pile had some utility, although it was obviously a very low perspective. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia reckons the phrase here, verse number 35, where it says, "But men throw it out," reckons it as if the person being referenced who has lost their salty flavor, their utility in this sense, was actually thrown on the dung pile himself. He was just cast out onto the pile of waste. And so the reference here is to the fact that the salt is very, very valuable as long as it is still salty and it has its savor and it represents what it is supposed to do. What is it that salt represents? What at the core does salt represent? Mark chapter 9, I want to read another passage, tie it in here to our responsibility to have an impact in this flesh. God didn't call us so that we could just tag along and attain salvation. God called us so that he could work through us, use us. When it says that we are the salt of the earth, it says that we are the light on the hill, a beacon to be seen. So the salt is tied in the same context the way light is used. What does light portray? Well, what does darkness portray? Darkness portrays away from God and his presence. Light portrays the light of God and his brightness, and the brightness that we will have when we are glory in our glory at Christ's return. Salt is used in a similar way. Again, we can see it as it begins to lay out in some of these verses. Mark chapter 9 and verse number 42. When you first read this, you wouldn't think that it necessarily tied in, just like you wouldn't think necessarily that Luke 14 tied in. But they all at the end bring back in this context of the example of salt. "Whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me, who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea." Don't do anything that is going to cause trouble for somebody who is young in the faith because they're not yet strong and mature. Be tender with them. Set a good example for them. Encourage them and help them along. Verse 43, "If your hand makes you sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life maimed, having two hands, to go to hell into fire that shall never be quenched." When it talks about the lake of fire, it's talking about destruction, having completely turned away from God. And then it goes on. It says, "If your foot makes you to sin," it says, "if your eye makes you to sin," get away from whatever it is that would cause us to fail. But the first verse says, "Whoever causes one of these little ones to stumble," get away from anything that's going to cause somebody else to stumble as well. Remove the sin from our life, but don't do anything to cast a stumbling block in front of someone else. It is talking about our example. It's talking about the things that we do and the impact that we have on each other here and those around us, even outside the church. Verse 49, again, going down to the end of the chapter, tied in. It's not like the context turns to a completely different place. It's the words of Jesus Christ if you have a version that shows them in red, and it continues on. Verse 49, "For, therefore, also, everyone will be seasoned with fire." Everyone is going to be tested. "And every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt." Salt is good. But if the salt loses its flavor, how do you season it? How do you turn back and make it salty again? "Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another." So we are to have salt in ourselves. And that salt is portraying God's presence. It portrays that presence of God by the Holy Spirit that gives us fruit and goes out and impacts each other in positive and significant ways. There are consequences of our actions and our behaviors. And the Bible says you should count the cost of your commitment. And then it says you are the salt of the earth. It says you should be careful not to offend. You are the salt of the earth, effectively, in that context. Everyone says will be seasoned by fire. Okay, I want to look at that, and then I want to look at every sacrifice will be seasoned by salt. 1 Peter 1 and verse number 6. First Peter 1, verse number 6. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials. Has anyone been grieved by various trials over the recent last couple of months? I mentioned that in a sermon, and I started getting emails from people who had listened to either the archives or were on the cybercast, and they said, "You bet. Never seen anything quite like it. Listen to this." And these are people, in some cases, that I know we have contact over the years. If you've been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Remember, it said everyone will be seasoned by fire. It's God's promise for our good. Whom having not seen, you love. Though now you do not see him, yet unbelieving, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Our preparation for salvation is through a testing by fire. And there is no other way. Chapter 4 of 1 Peter and verse number 12 says, "Beloved, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing is happening." Well, it sure seems strange to me, but I'll have to take God's word for it that this is something that, frankly, we're just going to walk through in this process. "But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he is blasphemed, but on your part he is glorified. Let none of you suffer, though, as a murderer, thief, and evildoer." Remember it said, don't offend any of these little ones. Don't do something wrong. You are salt. You are supposed to add a savor. You are to represent the light of the world, and people should come to you, and you should have an impact on them. You should change their taste in that sense by the way they look at you. "Do not suffer as a murderer, thief, an evildoer, a busybody in other people's matters. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify but God in the matter. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, then what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful Creator." So we are, in that sense, a living sacrifice. And it is portrayed that everyone then will be seasoned by fire. Then it said every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Sacrifices to God have to have God in its midst. You can't offer God that which is profane. We can only offer God that which is holy. Go back to Leviticus here, chapter 2 and verse 13. What did the sacrifices point to? Pointed to Jesus Christ. Leviticus 2, 13. What is it that was supposed to be a part of the sacrifices? Well, if I could ever find the book of Leviticus, I will tell you. Verse 13, Leviticus 2. It says, "Every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God." When it talks about making covenant with God in sacrifice, it refers to a covenant of salt, representing God's presence in that covenant. "You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt." God must be in the midst of that which is presented back to him. You cannot present to God that which is profane. If you look at salt and you study its characteristics, salt is a preservative. It prevents spoilage. It allows something to be stored and to be maintained. But it also has another interesting effect. Salt suppresses some flavors and accentuates others. Salt actually suppresses the sour and the bitter flavors. Now, who is it that designed our tongue? God did. Who is it that designed and created salt? It was God. I think it's amazing when we look at the tabernacle, and it's a tabernacle in the heaven. When we look at the images of things, they're like other things sometimes in the heavens. And there's things that go beyond probably what we surely understand. But salt suppresses bitterness in the tongue. And salt suppresses sourness on your taste. I think that goes a little bit beyond just coincidence. I've always thought it's fascinating. I like kippered herring. I'm the only one. I'm probably the only one at the store that ever goes and buys them, but I like kippered herring. They're very salty. And you can take Tabasco sauce and you can literally just coat the whole top of it with a layer of Tabasco because the salt tempers the heat in the peppers. It simply changes the flavor in such a way that it tempers it, the strength and the strong in that way. But it adds flavor to other things. Last night, sitting at my desk, and I got hungry, and I went up and I had in the kitchen, in the fridge, a little bucket of shiitake. Is that shiitake? Shiitake. Must be shiitake. Mushrooms. Now, mushrooms have almost no flavor at all. And probably if you had to just eat them by themselves, there'd be no market. So what do? You salt them. You boil them up in soy sauce. And literally, I sat there and I almost had to get my mind back on my sermon. I'm eating this phenomenal flavor and I'm working on this sermon and I'm saying, this is incredible. I've taken something that has almost no flavor at all and is, at least to me, it has become something that is wonderful and pleasant. And yet, salt is what God created. It adds to the flavor of things that have no flavor of their own. And it reduces the flavor of those things that are sour and that are bitter. I think God did that as a portrayal. He said to have salt always in your sacrifice. What are we? Romans 12 says that we're living sacrifice. We are the salt of the earth. It is to be in us. We are to have God's presence. We are to exemplify the way God would speak or the way he would act to avoid to cause offense, but also to give that light on the hill. Romans chapter 12 and verse number 1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Now look what it says. In your sacrifice, there's some things that are supposed to be reduced, and there are some things that are supposed to be accentuated, increased, and more fruitful. Don't be conformed to this world. Reduce the bitterness, and reduce the anger, and reduce the carnality that is all around us, and sometimes is too close to our heart. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove that which is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. We are to be reduced in the ways of this world, but we're to accentuate God's presence in our lives. We all have an impact on each other, and we have a great responsibility in that way. God portrayed the fact that we should watch the way we care for each other and the way we relate to each other. We have a great responsibility. It's part of the cost that we count, that we would be responsible in that way. Notice 1 Corinthians 7, verse number 13. Why would salt be attached to counting the cost? Why would salt be attached to not giving offense? But our salt is God in us. And it is the example that we set. It is the impact that we have on this world and the changes, the flavor, the accentuating of the positive elements around us. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 13 says, a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he's willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. The unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife. There's an impact there. There's a purity that is added to that relationship. The unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they're holy. The children themselves are sanctified. It says, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. But it says, how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? How do you know that your example and the fruit and the light that is in you will not change that other person in such a way that God can call them as well? Your impact is significant. 1 Peter 3 portrays it in a different light. 1 Peter 3 and verse number 1. That light on the hill, the salt of the earth, as those are used interchangeably, is something that people can see, and it changes them. And we have a responsibility to give account for ourselves in that way. 1 Peter 3 and verse number 1. It says, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word by your example may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Don't let your beauty be that outward adorning or arranging of the hair, or wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. It's that kernel of God's presence in our lives that comes out and becomes visible either to others by our, as they observe us, or in the relationships that we maintain. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. It says, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Again, we impact each other. The salt of God's presence in our lives would impact each other in a very positive way, that your prayers may not be hindered. How much of an impact do we have on this world? I think sometimes we think we walk out that door and we walk into a crowd of people and it's like we just dissolve and disappear. We have almost no impact at all. Do you know what? It is simply not true. It is not true because that is not God's way. How many righteous people were there that, by at least request, if there would have been 10 righteous people in Sodom, God would have spared the whole city? 10 righteous people. I wonder if we really wished Sodom would have been spared anyway. Why, those evil people, and by the portrayal in the Bible, they seemed almost needed to be destroyed. God said, for 10 people, I would spare them. I'd say that's a pretty heavy impact, even though it wasn't necessarily known at that time. If there would have been even just 10, God would have spared that city. How much of an impact does Israel have on the course of the world? Deuteronomy 32. I think it's a fascinating description of not what Israel does, but what God does and what his purposes are. We have no idea how much of an impact we have in this world and in our lives and in our communities, among our family and with our friends. We have no way to know what all God is willing to do. But in Deuteronomy 32 and verse number 7, it says, remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, you elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. He set the boundary of the peoples of the earth according to the numbers of the children of Israel, according to his plans. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. God says the course of world history has been impacted accordingly with his plans for the dispersing and then later the collection again of his people. Changed the course of the history of the world. Do you think that the church, God's people, spiritual Israel, is not even closer to God and more according to his purposes than physical Israel was? Do you think that we do not, in other ways as well, by the way God bears fruit through us, change the course of this world? When God says we are the salt of the earth, it means something. There's an impact there. Whether we can measure it ourselves, we will never necessarily know. But God says he uses us in a very significant way. Matthew 5 and verse 13 is where that passage comes from. Matthew 5 and verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, ultimately spiritual Israel, because it is God's presence in us that becomes the salt of the sacrifice. It is the salt that is savored. It is the salt that changes in a very positive and helpful way. You are the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its flavor, if you lose the presence of God, if you lose his impact in your life, then you're just without flavor and no purpose. How shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Who will be trampled underfoot? Those who are turned to ashes. You are the light of the world. Parallel analogy. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. In that sense, the salt, the impact of God's fruitfulness in our lives, and glorify your God in heaven. The gospel of the kingdom of God is that God is calling all men to salvation, but each in their time. How does the gospel go out? It goes out through his people. It goes out through the church. It goes out being published. The miracle of opening a mind is God's, but he works and sends it out through us. I came into the church through a family member. Some of you came in through a friend. Some of us came in because we heard it on the radio or picked up the magazine. I've heard of stories where the magazine was blowing down the street. Somebody picked it up, took it out of the trash, found it in a motel room. And God worked to open their mind. But there was some of God's people who put it there. The salt of the earth, changing the course of the world. 1 Peter 2 and verse number 4. First Peter 2 describes our priesthood. What does a priest do? A priest offers sacrifices with salt, but he also offers it on more than one altar. There are two altars in the temple. There is the altar on which the animals were sacrificed, and then there is the altar on which the incense was offered. Do you know what's in the incense as well? Salt. It's part of the mixture. So it describes that spiritual priesthood here, 1 Peter 2. He says, coming to him as a living stone, indeed rejected by men, but chosen by God and precious, you also as living stones are being built up in a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Again, offering up acceptable sacrifices. There were this altar of the animal sacrifice and the grain offerings, but there was the altar also of incense. And all of them tie in the symbolism of salt. Numbers 18. How do we look at what it is that God has called us to do? He has given us a gift. He's given us a gift of service, of being called to not only serve one another, but to serve this world as an example, to lead the way. The very definition of a first fruit is that they go first. And they are going to be followed by others who come along at another time. But they are the ones who shine the light, who go that way, who give reference to God's presence in them in that first calling. But Numbers 18, verse number 6, it's talking about the priesthood, God bringing the Levites in to care for matters of the temple. But notice how their service here is described. He says, "Behold, I myself have taken your brethren the Levites from among the children of Israel. They are a gift to you." See, God gave the priests as a gift to Israel, and he gave the Levites as a gift to the priests to help them in their service, given by the Lord to do the work of the tabernacle of meeting. Therefore, you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything at the altar and behind the veil, and you shall serve. I give you your priesthood as a gift for service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. It isn't just anybody that can walk into the presence of God. You walk in and worship God according to his calling and according to his command. Now again, remember, with all of your offerings, Leviticus 2, you shall offer salt. Go down to verse 19 here of Numbers 18, and it just makes a particular reference to a specific type of offering. All the heave offerings of the holy things, a heave offering was something that was given and the priest could use it for their sustenance and food. It was a type of a first fruit offering, which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and to your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants before you. God said, my gift of the first fruit offering in this way is a covenant of salt. It is my representation of my gift to you. Therefore, you will be able to then give as well to the people. It is a type of God's plan in that way. Salt, as I said, was also tied into offering of the incense. Revelation 8 portrays the prayers of God's people as incense. It says, when he opened the seventh seal, Revelation 8 verse 1, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar, and he was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints. Now it's offered with the prayers, but it mingles. So it's portrayed in this context. Offered with the prayers of all the saints and the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. All right? Our prayers are part of the sacrifice that we offer in the priesthood, our spiritual priesthood of our calling. And if we go back in Exodus 30, we see how that incense was made. And again, salt is part of what God put in there symbolically because of what it represents. You can only pray, it says, the Spirit will pray even for us when we don't even know what to say, that it will guide and direct us. Last week was a really unusual circumstance in the way it played out. I had prepared a sermon to go down to Lewiston, and it was what I had worked on through the week, and I had narrowed my notes and I had written it up, and I'm finishing it as we're driving down. Jerry Case was driving. And so I got down and I had told Alan. Alan had it on the cybercast for the title. And I gave it. We had our hour. And when I was done, on the way home, I was rather discouraged. And I just thought back and I looked at what I had done and I said, that wasn't the best. And I mentioned to Jerry, I said, I feel like I just didn't give what needed to be in that way. And Jerry says, well, maybe that's what they needed to hear. But I felt kind of discouraged, and I said, I've got to rewrite this. I've got to fix the focus in this, and I've got to go another place. So Jerry got quiet because I started writing a sermon in the car. So I'm writing all the way back to Post Falls, right up to the time you walk in the door. In fact, I sat out in the car for a few minutes to finish the sermonette time and some announcement time before I actually went in to use every minute I had. But I completely rewrote the sermon in the car. Now, I don't like to do that at all. Hope to not ever have to do that again. But I completely built the sermon separately, got up, gave the sermon, and then I felt like, okay, that I had finally accomplished, hopefully, the task. Alan afterwards says, well, you know, that title didn't fit very well on that sermon. Well, you're right, because that title wasn't that sermon at all. That was a completely different sermon. Jerry said, well, I heard two different sermons today. And I finally, it bothered me a little bit. Finally, I called Diane up, Hasnerl, and it was a couple days later. And I said, Diane, I want you to just tell Joe, and I just want to tell you, I apologize for Sabbath. I just didn't think I had offered as quality of something as useful as it should have been. For whatever reason, I didn't have my focus. I said, I tried to fix it. If you listen to the archives, you'll hear the sermon I gave up in Post Falls, and I think you'll find maybe it'd be more helpful. And she didn't say much. She just was kind of quiet. So anyway, I got a note from Joe later, and he said, you know, I really did appreciate what you gave on the Sabbath, because he said it was just exactly what I needed. It helped me, and he explained in a very specific way. He says, I started to write you a note on Sunday thanking you for hitting something that was so well prepared for my needs that I was just grateful. He said, I didn't actually get the word off to you at that time. And then I had to look back, and I just thought, is that amazing? It is amazing to me. What I processed as failure would appear to have been God saying, okay, now, Mark, I need you to go another way. The needs of one congregation were different that day than the needs of another. And it was certainly frustrating to me to try to turn that corner, but to come back to church today and begin to again talk to members of the congregation here and the way those sermons played out, and I look back and I says, you know, God is working through us. We don't even know always how he does it. If we're sincere, if we submit ourselves to him fully, if we will put him first and try to submit to his will, then that light on the hill, that salt of the earth, who knows the impact that is at having changes. I thought I had failed, at least it seemed to me. And I was grateful, at least later on, to find out that it had been helpful, at least in some way. God has the power. He is the one working through us. All of our offerings are to have God in their midst. All of our prayers are to have God in their midst. And yet we are a priesthood, a spiritual priesthood that God says, I will work with you. You are my special treasure. And believe me, we will change the world, not because of what you and I do on our own, but because of God working through us. We have no way to know how much of an impact we clearly will have. Exodus 30. Verse 34, the Lord said to Moses, take sweet spices, mentions a bunch of things I can't pronounce, equal amounts of each. That's how we cook at home. You just dump it in the bowl and see how it comes out. It says, you make these an incense, a compound according to the art of the perfumer, salted, pure, and holy. Salt portrays purity. Salt portrays holiness. The way it is used here. And this was the incense that was offered up to God. We are the salt of the earth. And everything that we do, the words we say, the thoughts we think, the actions that we carry out, are to be salted as a perfume of incense in that sense, as a sacrifice on the altar, offered with salt, God in its midst, as it is offered before each other. And before God as well. Book of Colossians, chapter 4, verse number 2, talks about Christian graces, is the title that the New King James has here. Basic fundamental principles of this Christian life. Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. Praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains. Paul goes a prisoner to Rome and ends up preaching the gospel in the household there of the rulers. and yet he goes there in chains. That I may make it manifest or known as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, God in its midst, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Brethren, when God says that we're the salt of the earth, that's just not some analogy that has no basis or meaning. It's not just some cute little phrase that we throw out and don't think about what it really implies. What it implies is that God is there in our midst using us. And whatever it is that we do, in our sacrifice or in our prayers, we must look to God and we offer up Him when we offer up ourselves to each other as well.